Coming up, Jamie King joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. It's Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hey, everybody.
Again in sync, red, white, and blue, all American.
You bet.
Got our stickers on. We both voted.
We're both in stripes.
Yeah, or this kind of means I was too lazy to change. And
Oh, my God.
I love voting. It's like a Capra movie. You know, you meet people.
There's
all sorts of. I voted. They changed my voting place. Normally, they have it at a retirement home, but this year was at a firehouse.
Fun. Oh, it was also fun.
Very festive.
Mine's always at a church.
Oh, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they changed mine around. But anyway, it was just lovely. I mean, older folks, younger folks. There was a woman with two pit bulls.
Interesting.
A lot of people took pictures of her. A
couple years ago.
Vote Democrat! or my dogs will eat you.
There was a couple who has like a big Halloween, you know, fiesta on Halloween night, and they were, I think, Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein last year.
Oh, good one.
And, or 2 years ago, and yeah. I saw them at the polls, obviously not in makeup, and recognized them because they were together, and I knew they were my neighbors, and I knew they lived close by. And I was like, hey, is this you? Showing them a photo of them from Halloween, and they were like, how did you know? So, excellent deduction skills. But it's always fun seeing your neighbors. And
love it.
Yeah, I do love it. When I was a kid, our house was a polling place. Our garage was a polling place a couple of times.
That's so funny. I have a friend of mine votes in someone's garage.
Yeah, it was in our garage.
But we're in Hollywood, so it could be someone famous.
It could be.
Enough about our voting. We have to get to
Jamie. But we hope you all did.
We're going to get to Jamie King today. I'm so excited. I love Sin City. That's such a movie that, you know, you can kind of. If it's on late at night, just kind of zone out and watch. But a couple things going on. One is I must plug a film. It hasn't come out yet. Because I'm an Academy member, I get to go to a lot of these screenings for films, which is always, of course, the amazing way to see a movie. I want to plug Julian Schnabel's film At Eternity's Gate. It's about the life of Vincent van Gogh, and it stars Willem Dafoe and Oscar Isaacs, and Oscar Isaac.
Wow.
And just an incredible film visually. The photography is stunning.
I would hope.
And you kind of think you, not that I thought this, because I love Diving Bell and the Butterfly. I love Basquiat.
Yeah.
Which are also his films, but you think, oh, well, you know, what are they going to add to this? And I don't want to give too much away, but just the way they shot it and the approach that they took to make it very present, very almost realistic. And you're seeing like best of Vincent van Gogh, you know, we know all the paintings, we know all the stories, but they found a fresh approach to the film. And it also talks a lot about the artist in our society, you know, which is this idea, which is so compelling for me, that if nobody thinks you're any good, are you compelled to do your art anyway?
Right.
And it's
success being dependent upon the audience receiving you.
Yeah.
I've had that conversation with so many people.
And it's a very beautiful film. Some people have taken the approach that he's a tortured artist, and And this film does not take that approach. This film, in my opinion, takes the approach that he's sane and everyone else is crazy.
Oh.
It's just a beautiful film. The music, the soundtrack is absolutely stunning. I wish I could remember the name of the woman. I cannot at this moment, who did the soundtrack. It's absolutely stunning, and I highly recommend it. And I recommend it especially for Willem Dafoe, who has just been on the scene in so many movies, and he's like Kevin Bacon. He's so good that people just go, oh, yeah, of course he's good.
Right.
Let's give it to an English guy this year. And so I hope people see this film. I know all the big, big films are coming out.
Yeah.
And it's one of the smaller ones that I hope, you know, that I highly recommend.
Excellent.
Also, another plug for literally my favorite show that has come on, Tales from the Tour Bus, Mike Judge. They did the last year, and this is basically an animated series. If you like music and if you like stories about music from the way, way back machine.
Uh-huh.
The first time they did it was about country music people like Merle Haggard and George Jones. It was absolutely hysterical and touching and wonderful. This year they're doing funk. So
excellent.
They did the first show about George Clinton. This week is coming up Rick James. Very excited to see that because way back in the day when I worked for Steve Rubell at the Hotel Executive, which later became Morgan's, Rick James did in fact live at the hotel and had the tour bus outside. And yeah, it was.
Read the book if you want to know more of the story.
We used to call up Steve and be like, he's in the lobby. His bathrobe is completely opened. There's people here from Nebraska. We don't know what to do. You know, but those were the good old fun days. And finally for me, and then it's on to you. I don't know what you're going to plug. The TCM, I've run conveniently out of time. The TCM, the Kino Larber Pioneers of Cinema will be on again tomorrow night on TCM, hosted by Alicia Malone. And I will be there talking about all these great female filmmakers from the silent era, writers, actresses, and directors. Just an incredible an array of films, and I'm so glad that they're showing it. And if you want to pick up the Kino Larber DVD, you can. I would love that. It was put together mainly because of a Kickstarter. So
oh, no kidding.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's going to be my future. It's going to be like, can we raise a Kickstarter to, you know, or food, you know?
Yeah, or both.
Yes, a Kickstarter. That's what artists, that's what the movie is about at Eternity's Gate. Never sold a picture.
No, he didn't.
In his lifetime. It was just an incredible film. And incredible, I blew the whole thing. I swear we're going to get to Jamie King. They had the party afterwards. It wasn't really a party. It was
sort of
a luncheon at John Lautner's house, the architect, the spaceship house, which is where they shot the Brian De Palma movie.
In Palm Springs.
No, it's in the Hollywood Hills off of Mulholland.
Oh, got it. Okay.
But it's the spaceship, you know, house, or Chemosphere is, I think, believe the official name. And oh my God, that was exciting. And again, it's just one of the fun perks. Of like, okay, the movie was great. I'm going to get to talk to the filmmakers, but to get to be at that incredible house, meet the owners, talk to them about it. And that was amazing. Hollywood's a great place. You just got to look for the fun little architecture and stuff like that.
And interesting people.
I'm done blabbing. I'm just up. I'm up. I voted. I'm an American. I'm ominous.
There's not brandy in her cup. I promise. It's tea.
I'm like Trump now.
I'm ominous. Yeah.
We're all nervous. It's like the SNL.
That was me. I saw that and I was like crying, laughing when I saw it. I tweeted it.
Point.
It's hilarious. Unfortunately, our international fans can't see it because one of our Australian fans, Peter, mentioned that they can't view those videos in international places.
I love our fans. So our fans are so great. Thanks everybody for listening and making comments. And we all love
awesome.
Movies. We got to hang on to something for sure.
Let's bring in Jamie.
Yeah, I'm very excited. As I said, I'm a huge fan of Sin City. But my guest today is perhaps best known for her roles in My Bloody Valentine, Sin City, of course, where she played the twins, White Chicks, Blow, which was the Ted Demme film, Pearl Harbor. Can't wait to talk about that one. Heart of Dixie, and her next project is Black Summer, and it's going to air on Netflix next spring. She's also an entrepreneur, so we're going to talk to her about that. But hello and welcome, Jamie King.
Thank you.
We've never met, so this will be fun. Like, we've met across a crowded room or, you know. And would you talk, if you saw me at a party, would you talk to me or would you turn the other way?
I talk to everybody at parties if I can, because I actually like to talk to people, and I find that people don't really like to talk to people at parties.
You know, it's funny. I notice it too. I think LA, they're just always afraid that, well, they're either there to try to get a job, you know,
at, yeah.
Or you're interrupting. I remember one time like being somewhere and I wanted to, I saw Tom Hanks, and I kind of knew him from various little social things, and I wanted to talk to him, but he was wanting to talk to Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
And so it was like, I was like, this is not a good time. Like, he just, you know, just to go like, hey, Tom, remember me? We did that thing. And then he just looked at me like, I'm talking to Bruce Springsteen. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's always an interesting thing, because I think that no matter who you are or where you come from, I think that it's part of the human condition to feel like you're not really supposed to be there.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, everyone feels like they look at stars or whoever's there and like, oh, I'm not. But even I feel like actors and artists feel the same way, you know, like ultimately, like, yeah, they're supposed to be there, but there's still some part of them that feels like, you know, like it's not. Like an outsider.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing that is interesting me about a lot of these parties is that, you know, I'm interested in the human connection, which is why I'm an artist and why I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. I want this. I want to have that. And when you're talking to some people and they're like, oh yeah, so how's everything going? You know, oh yeah. You know, they're like always like looking over your shoulder to see who else is like to clock the room.
Yeah,
and that is one of my biggest pet peeves ever. So I always know like it's a good person when they're looking you in the eye and you are having a conversation. Because it's impossible to work an entire room.
Right.
So I end up finding like, you know, one corner and I'll meet people and just sort of like hang out in that space.
But let me ask you this. Because I know the answer for me. Did you ever get a job from like networking a party? I haven't. One time I did. One time I was at Wes. I was invited to a party at Wes Craven's house, mm-hmm. and I made Wes Craven laugh. And the next day, his producer like called my agent and was like, Wes wants her to do, and of course the movie was Cursed, which was Cursed.
Yeah, yeah.
And I ended up getting cut anyway. But I was like, what? They were like, he thinks you're really funny, and that's the only, and I wasn't, but I wasn't trying to network.
Yeah, well, that's the difference. I'm really trying to think if I got anything from a party.
You know, no, when you get all dressed up.
And, you know, it's like by the time you get the hair, the makeup, the this, and that, you're already exhausted by the time you get there.
That's what I mean.
And I think the value of it for me, if I choose to go, because I'm always on that like weird precipice of like, do I really want to? I know this sounds like a great idea, but there's a part of me that kind of wants to either be with my kids, or if I have to work the next day, I tend to be very much like a perfectionist. And then I'm thinking, oh, how many hours of sleep will I get? But so I feel like a lot of the times I kind of have to push out of like, I'm an introvert extrovert. So I have to push out of my introverted nature and say, no, go do it. And I think that the value that I receive is being with other artists that I actually enjoy, reconnecting with them if I haven't seen them in a while, or getting to know people or meeting people that I haven't met before. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but it's like, the one thing about Hollywood that's very fascinating to me is that somehow, like, if you're in the club, then there is no, like, it's like everybody just knows each other. Like, they'll come up, even if they've never met you before, I've never met someone, you can just walk up to someone and be like, hey, how's it going? They're like, oh, hey. Like, you know what I mean? It's a very fascinating thing where, you know, it's somehow everybody just kind of knows of each other, but it then immediately like takes away that thing of having to cut through all this other stuff, you know?
See, I have the opposite thing. I'm always so insecure that like I've met people and I've had an experience where, you know, I did a show and Melanie Griffith was on the show and I was like, well, I kind of met her. Why am I going to say anything? And then she comes up to me like,
hey,
aren't you going to say hi?
I know, right?
That's what usually happens to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I didn't think you'd remember.
But
like,
that's what I'm talking about, because I'm very much the same way. You know, like ever since I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
I love.
Thank you.
I love them. We're going to get to my first question and all that. But, you know, and I interrupted you. We're going to talk about how I love Nebraska, but finish your thought.
Thank you. Yeah, so I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and I definitely didn't fit in at all. You know, when I was growing up, it was very much about like if you were a cheerleader or a jock, and I looked a certain way, but I didn't come from a lot of money and I just didn't fit in. And every time I tried to fit in, it was like I got my ass kicked more, you know, like it was really harsh. And then I had an old, one of my older sisters, you know, who, stunningly beautiful cheerleader, so popular, everybody loved her. And then my eldest sister, who came out as gay in the 80s, which was a really rare thing there. And thankfully my parents, like, you know, made our home a safe haven for the LGBTQ community. Sorry, this is I have kids and I didn't sleep last night. And that was really amazing because I didn't even know that that was really going on, because it was never a time where it was like, oh, my sister came out. It just kind of always was. And it wasn't until I went to New York and went to my first Pride parade that I realized, oh, my sister's gay. And, and like in our family, it just was what it was. So my parents accepted each one of us as individuals, but it felt like the world around me didn't, you know, accept me in that way. And, you know, I really had to, like, I've found that I've had to work through that my whole life. You know, this idea of that, you know, that I'm worthy of getting things. I'm worthy of using my voice. I'm worthy of sharing my artistry, and that I'm not gonna, you know, that I belong at this table, that we all belong at this table and have something valuable to say.
Right.
But it's taken, you know, a lot, and ultimately I'm grateful for it, because all of the things I went through as a child and as a teenager, you know, I've been able to really look at through the work, you know, and use that for the work, you know, through, for my scenes, for my acting, and because I have a deep compassion, empathy for people that don't fit in. And when I saw, you know, film and television and musicians, they made me feel less alone. They reflected something back to me that I could say, oh my God, yes, yes, that's me too. And, you know, that was a huge thing for me, where I knew as a young child that I had to reflect humanity back to humanity. I had to do what I was receiving from these other people. And I didn't know any of these people, obviously, because I was a child, but I felt like they understood me more than the people around me.
Were these, so going back to Omaha, Nebraska, where you grew up, do you remember, of course, my favorite question, the first movie you saw and who took you to see it? And
I was thinking about that on the way here, and then I called my mom and I was like, Mama, what was the first movie I saw in the theater? Because movies were such a big part of my life. And my mom, you know, she's like, we took you to see everything. And I just remember seeing so many movies and then always watching movies at home. And my mom was such a huge influence on me in terms of watching movies, because, you know, she grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. She was a housewife, but there was always Barbara Streisand playing, or Bette Midler, or Julie Andrews. And, you know, she was really attracted to women that gave her a sense of strength, that were strong in who they were. And, you know, I remember she went to go see Star Wars when it first came out 3 times in the movie theater. She saw A Star Is Born 3 times, you know. So I was asking her these questions to sort of try and jog my memory of, like, what I first saw in the theater versus what I repeatedly, what I would see and then watch over and over at home. And I think, like, one of the first movies that I remember seeing was Gremlins, Back to the Future, Roger Rabbit, you know what I mean? Like those were the ones that I remember seeing. I saw Ghostbusters, Ferris Bueller. Those are like some of the first memories of seeing it, like, on a big screen.
Right.
But we had so many movies at home, and you know when you could take, like, the VHS disc and you could record over it? And so, like, all of our VHS discs had so much masking tape on it because, you know, we'd record everything over and over and over again.
Right.
You know, and so the movies I watched over and over again were, like, 9 to 5, Grease, Xanadu, Mask, you know, The Breakfast Club. What else?
Yeah, it was a great VHS time.
Oh my God, it was amazing.
You know, to watch films. Now in Omaha, because I did a movie there. Did you ever meet Alexander Payne?
Yes. I actually met him at a party.
He's from Omaha. You got an in.
Yeah. And he's fantastic. I met him, I think it was at Ariana Huffington's, who's a dear friend of mine for a long time. And I was actually getting ready to do my first short film in Nebraska, mm-hmm. that I had written and was directing. And, you know, he was amazing because, you know, we were talking about, you know, what we could do to bring more film there. And growing up in Nebraska, to me, created a space in which I could always dream, because the land is so flat and the sky is so big and it's just so beautiful there. And I don't think that people realize, like, when I hear people call it like the flyover states, that always really bothers
me.
You know, like people in Hollywood are like, oh, the flyover states. I was like, guys, these are the people that are actually buying the tickets to your movies.
Right.
You know, over and over again.
The foundation of America.
Exactly.
You know, when you're in Nebraska and Missouri and these big farmhouses and these flat land, you know, that's what I always think of, is the people. It's not so much the current industrialization as I think of, like, these were the pioneers.
Literally. My family came over on the Mayflower, you know, so like, and I've been in Nebraska, you know, ever since they came over, Iowa, Nebraska, you know. But what I love about seeing film, like, you know, Alexander's films there and anything there, is that you can just point the camera anywhere, mm-hmm. and it's beautiful. And I love the idea of exploring what it's like, what life is like there as well. And I'm just so grateful I was raised there, because, you know, there really wasn't a lot to do, but that was because I was so highly creative. You know, that was the foundation of my imagination. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I asked if he had any advice, and I asked for his support. And I remember he left me a really beautiful long message on my answering machine at home. And, you know, it's those kinds of things when you have filmmakers like that, that are like, I have your back.
Yeah.
I will mentor you, whatever it is that you need. And, you know, when I flew there to make the movie, it was fantastic because everybody got behind it. It's like, I got a school for free. You know, I got like just so much stuff. It made it look so rich. And I got to tell my story in a way where people were just really happy mm-hmm. to be a part of it, you know?
Yeah, it's I can't say enough about Omaha. I spent time there, and I really like it. So you originally became a model, but did you want to be an actress or how did the modeling?
I always wanted to be a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and I loved anything that had anything in regards to art. So, you know, I remember when I was 10, I saw photographs that Nan Golden had taken, and I couldn't find any of her books anywhere, pre-internet. And I begged my mom to please save money to take me to a city. Mm-hmm. Because my mom would always take us to, like, the local theaters, and I wanted to go see Les Miserables, and I wanted to go see the Martha Graham Dance Studio, and I had to get Nan Golden's books. And so when I was 11, my mom flew me to Chicago, which was the first time that I'd been on an airplane. And I remember being in this city and everything, like, I just felt like, oh my God, you know, it was just the most exciting thing. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, so exciting that my mom, who inherently had always been an artist, you know, we were going on this journey together. And, you know, when I found The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, Nan's book, and brought that home, and I looked at the photography and the way that it would make me feel, and it being a woman, and the way that she shot her friends and, you know, the community, and people just weren't shooting like that now. It was a really rare thing. And, you know, I'd been writing since I was really young, and I just found a book that I wrote when I was 7 called The Greatest Poems in the Galaxy. And I look at it, and I was reading it with my mom, and I was like, I can't believe I was writing this stuff at 7 years old. That seemed far beyond my years, that normally would be like, didn't really hold up. But it was like one of those things where she's like, well, you always wrote. And so I was always putting on plays in the basement. My cousins, you know, poor cousins in my family, I would assign them their roles. And, you know, like, it was always a part of my life. And when I turned 12, I saw an advertisement in the newspaper for Nancy Bowne's modeling studio. And it said if you went to this modeling studio that you would meet an agent from New York. Mm-hmm. And all I wanted to do was to get to another city so that I could become a filmmaker. And fashion to me seemed like a natural segue. I was just a kid. I was like, oh, I can get to New York. I can get an agent. Perfect. I can, maybe I'll meet Nan Goldin one day. Maybe I'll meet Avedon. Maybe I'll meet these people that really inspire me. And then I can, you know, utilize that time there to travel around the world mm-hmm. and get experience and, you know, become a filmmaker. So there was always this thing since I was young where I just, I didn't question it. Mm-hmm. I questioned everything else about myself, but the one thing I didn't question is that I was going to do it no matter what. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's kind of great about, you know, artists is that artists just know, and it's an aching, it's a longing. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it because there's so much rejection. Right. You know, you're hustling your butt off all the time. You never know if you're going to work or not going to work. You know, one minute you're in favor, the next minute you're not. It's like, it is a constant, it's like living on the edge all the time. And if you don't have the fortitude to do that, and it's not just about fortitude, it means that you have to love it that much that you are willing to put everything on the line, that there's nothing else in the world that you can imagine doing.
So when you got to New York, I mean, was modeling what you thought it was going to be, or?
I mean, what was interesting is that as soon as I got there, you know, I started shooting for Vogue. I started shooting, you know, for all the top magazines. I worked with Avedon. I wrote with Avedon. I was approached by the New York Times when I was 15, and they said, there's a young writer named Jennifer Egan, cut to like Pulitzer Prizes later, she's brilliant, who's doing an article about young models. And I said, no, thank you. I'm not interested. And then they said Nan Goldin was going to shoot it. And I like my brain just like exploded. I really couldn't believe it. And then when Nan and I met, she's like, I don't want to shoot anybody else. I only want James. And so Nan documented my life. And when I so that came out, the cover of the New York Times Magazine, an article called James is a Girl. That came out when I turned 16. And the minute that that came out and I stepped out the door, my life changed overnight. And I think what it was is that people were not only reading, you know, a really brilliant piece, but they were seeing the vulnerabilities and the truth of like what it was like to be a child in an industry where they were telling your parents that you're being protected, but you weren't really being protected, mm-hmm. you know, and also understanding myself that as a child, I always felt older than I was, but I also had this like, you know, I felt like at the same time, like I was missing out on my youth, but there was no way to really reconcile that because I knew I really couldn't have both. Mm-hmm. And so I just did whatever I could to keep following, you know, the path that I wanted to follow. And that really wasn't an easy thing. And, you know, I'm grateful because I met so many amazing people. And, you know, I remember when I first met Alexander McQueen and we were both so young, I was 14 and it was his first show and he was one of my best friends. And, you know, watching his journey and, you know, these really extraordinary human beings that really shaped me and, you know, taught me so much. And then by the time I turned 18, I knew that I was done and I had saved all my money and people thought I was crazy. And, you know, Tobey Maguire and Leo DiCaprio and Joaquin Phoenix and Stephen Dorff, these are all guys that I was friends with that were really, really supportive of that I'd met before that mm-hmm. were deeply supportive of me transitioning into acting. And of course, my agents at the time were like, what are you doing? You're at the height of your career. You know, I had so many campaigns. Like, it seemed like, you know, everyone's greatest wish. They're like, you're 18 years old. You want to quit now? And I'm like, I had been watching the way that Leo had worked and Joaquin and how hard they studied and what they were making and what they were doing. And, you know, to be around that and to see how dedicated they were, even at that time in their lives, it's like they never missed a class. They had a study group with a great teacher. You know, there was things that I learned from them that were so invaluable to me as an artist. And so when I did transition, you know, I knew that I always had to study. I knew that, you know, there were particular things. You know, one of them said to me, I won't ever forget, they're like, never be in the press for anything unless you have something coming out to promote, you know? And I really thought about that. And that was something that was really interesting to me and important to me. And, you know, and now it's so different because the media takes over everything. But right. it was instilled inside of me that the actor never stops learning, and that it doesn't matter if you're in one scene or in a whole movie, you know, what you are doing is meaningful, you know, and you have to honor the craft of what you're doing, of storytelling, and not rest on your laurels and just say, oh, I've got it now. Mm-hmm. You know, you just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. And, you know, so I really credit, you know, having friends that had my back to make a transition that no one had really done before. You know, people like had maybe in the 70s, but in the 90s, like, you know, you had supermodels that had done like a couple movies, but they didn't quit and then have to reestablish themselves as an actor, which was, you know, difficult, you know, because if I went into a room, they already knew who I was. So I had to break this idea of who they thought that I was,
right,
and show them, you know, who I was as an artist. And, you know, when I was able to do that, it was, you know, it was a dream come true, because all of a sudden I was like, this is it. I worked so hard and gave up a lot, and you know, I just won't stop.
So since I always have to, I worked with Paulina Poretskova, and I asked her this too. How do you not become self-conscious of the very cliche of like, I'm walking the catwalk, I'm doing this, I'm doing that? Like, how do you make it fresh?
You know, I think the thing is, and I think
something
it,
you've
it
seen 8 million times.
Yeah, right.
I mean, but when you're watching it, when you're watching Naomi Campbell, you're like, oh my God, like,
no, she's a freaking goddess.
She has got it.
And but, she's dope, you know.
But how do you do that like 8 million times?
I think the thing is that because I was so young, and if like, and this, I think the article kind of, the, you know, when that article came out,
yeah,
it really showed, I think, the difference between the way that I approached the industry versus a lot of other people. A, I was the youngest kid. B, you know, we had a huge transition. I never thought I'd be able to actually be a model, because you had to be 5'10 and above and have, you know, like this banging kind of body. Mm-hmm. And I was not that tall. And, you know, when Kate Moss came in and Jamie Rashar, you had a movement of a different type of woman that they were exploring all different kinds of looks, you know, and thankfully, like, that is the time when I got into that. And so, you know, I remember my first show, Naomi Ferrucci was my first show, and Naomi was in front of me and Kate Moss was standing behind me, and I was like, what the like, I couldn't even, you know, but I didn't know the rules, the regulations, the how to act, how not to act. And it was really an explosion of a time where, you know, in the 90s, which also deeply impacted filmmaking, you know, it was like Nirvana, the Seattle grunge scene. It was like the kids were coming up and they were shaking things around, and it was a different kind of revolution. We saw that like in Trainspotting. We saw that in so many movies that were coming out then. We saw that, you know, Pulp Fiction, like all of that kind of stuff. It was just a different, like, the music and film and fashion have always been intrinsically related to one another. And so in terms of making it fresh, I just was who I was. And I think that, you know, my personality was more theatrical, or, you know, I was always kind of leaning into different mm-hmm. vibes or feelings. So on the runways, or, you know, when I was shooting, it was always like I was acting. Do you know what I mean? I would just feel the music or feel how I was right. feeling in that moment, and I would just do it intuitively. And so it wasn't ever a rote thing for me. And in a way, that's kind of what I became known for, is not just, you know, how I looked, but who I was as a human being and how I brought that into the work.
That attitude.
Yeah, and that article, interestingly enough, when I first met Lena Dunham, you know, I mean, I had always been like such a huge fan of hers, and we all went on a vacation together, and it was a, you know, I think it was Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield and, you know, Jack Antonoff and Lena, like all these really fun people had been brought together by a girlfriend of mine. And, you know, I look over at Lena and I'm just like freaking out, like fangirling out, you know, really just like, at the time, you know, it was rare to have a female voice like hers, you know, and she was doing something that was quite unique at the time. And she said, you know, I want to let you know that I became a writer because of you. And I was like, what? You know, and she's like, when I read James is a Girl, that changed my life. Hmm. And she, you know, posted it next to her bedside, And she said, that made me want to be a writer. And I just, you know, like, I can't take credit for that. I feel like that, you know, that's Nan and myself and Jen Egan and, you know, the sort of alchemy that took place with that thing. But it was so crazy to me how full circle things are when we, you know, really connect with people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you tell them how they've impacted your life. And then you realize that, like, somehow some part of you or piece of you or action has impacted theirs. And, like, that's the beautiful thing about artists that I love so much, you know, is how we can all, you know, connect to one another in that way. And I think the most beautiful thing is when people are willing to get out of their ego or their fear of saying what they really want to say and telling you how, you know, like when I can get out of that space and, you know, just be really honest with people about how they've changed my life, you know. And I've done that many, many, many times. And that's the one thing like that overcomes me at times, you know, when I'm at parties or when I'm on a set is I just can't not say it. And, you know, I lost the first love of my life when I was 17 years old. And when that happened, I realized that there is no time to not tell people that you love them. There's no time to not tell a woman she looks beautiful when she's walking down the street. There is no time to hold back what it is that you want to say. Mm-hmm. You know, so I have a very overwhelming experience sometimes of just needing to share with someone the beauty that I see in them.
And, the immediacy.
And the immediacy of it.
Yeah. No, I completely understand. So getting into movies, was the first movie you did Happy Campers with Daniel Waters?
Mm-hmm.
We know Daniel. He hasn't done the show yet. He keeps
saying, he's the best. Well, you have to get him a bus or an Uber because he doesn't drive.
Oh, okay. I see him at the Egyptian quite a lot.
Yeah,
he's usually sitting behind me with Josh Olson. And
yeah,
Josh says we're going to get him on the show.
He's just the best.
Yeah,
I mean that was a game changer, obviously, because Heathers was one of my all time favorite movies. Basically, yeah. Anything Winona Ryder was in, like. She was like a goddess to me. I was obsessed with everything that she did. And Heathers was just like, you know, like game changing. And that was when I said, oh, this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somehow I got linked up with Daniel Waters through Denise Tenovi, who also like bowed down to that. She's such a queen. They were doing Happy Campers, and Daniel had said that he had seen a picture of me in a magazine, and that when he saw that photograph, it inspired him to write that character.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was flown out to Los Angeles. I auditioned 6 times and got that part. And again, it's like one of those full circle things, because this is someone that, you know, had written something that had impacted my youth in such a big way that,
yeah.
You know, and I just like the whole thing, I couldn't really, you know, believe that it was happening. And what was beautiful about it is that at that time, and I don't know if this happened to you, but like when I first started acting, there was no acting. It just was like, mm-hmm. I was just able to look at it and be the character wholly and freely, because I didn't know what a producer was. I didn't know the hierarchy of things. I didn't know you had to open up a box office. Like, I knew of it from like my friends or whatever. I remember the pressure. I remember seeing when I was sitting with Leo when Titanic came out, and I remember he was like sitting on a bed with his hands like this, and the news came on and it showed like what a huge success it was. And I saw within 2 seconds someone completely, like the realization come over someone's face that their whole life had changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I knew that there was those things, but I was so fresh to it that I didn't feel that responsibility. And so, you know, even though I was working, you know, with the teacher and things like that, I was grateful. Now that I look at it, I just wanted to be free, and I wasn't confined by, you know, what I thought I should do or how I should do it, and I wasn't in my head about it. And then I'll never forget when they called action, like they called rolling, and then all of a sudden I had like a freak out, and I was like, what do I do? You know, like, and I turned to Justin Long, thank God, you know, and he's like, they're gonna call action, and then you just act. And I was like, wait, like, it's really happening? Do you know what I mean? Like, I legit, like, and everything was so fascinating, you know, like, oh my God, they have bags that don't make sounds, and like the magic of, yeah, you know, the set, and, you know, Peter Stormare, and, you know, Brad Renfro, and, you know, Dominique Swain, and I had seen her in Lolita, and I just thought that she was everything, and, you know, you know, just the whole experience of it was like opening up Pandora's box, you know?
Well, you had some like pretty racy scenes. Were you at all intimidated for your first movie and be like, you know, I'm going to be this like hot, have a hot lesbian scene? I mean, it seems for that type, for that year, it just seems like a long time ago. Now it just seems like, oh yeah, we'll get this before lunch.
See, that part like didn't bother me at all. You know, because I was raised, you know, in a family with a sister that was openly gay. I also then was raised in the fashion community where, you know, most of my best friends mm-hmm. were gay or bisexual or trans or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I never saw, you know, my mom started calling me James, you know, ever since I was little. And so I never really, it's not that I don't identify with being a woman, but I feel very masculine and feminine at the same time.
Right.
And I had already had a girlfriend before, you know, so I'd already, you know, I feel like I was able to explore a lot of things at a young age that didn't seem like it was risque. It just seemed to me that I was taught that if you love someone, you can love someone, and that sexual expression or kissing, that intimacy is an expression of that love. And so, you know, I thought that scene was really beautiful, and I wasn't afraid of it because I didn't think that I was doing anything wrong or that it was taboo because I wasn't raised in an environment where it was taboo.
Yeah.
I was more afraid, frankly, of a scene where I had to lift up my top, mm-hmm. you know, and I, like, you know, paint on my breast, and I really didn't want to do that scene because I had an acute awareness that, you know, in the fashion industry, that from a very young age, you know, I was exploited as a sexual being at a far too young of an age, and that I saw things that I never should have seen, you know, but I didn't know any different. And again, because they weren't always on the up and up, like with my family, my parents would never have let that happen. Right. But, you know, like I would be doing Italian Vogue, you know, at 14 years old, you know, with some huge photographer and be naked in a bathtub. And, you know, and I would look around and everybody else at that age was doing it. And so I had a deep fear inside of me that if I didn't do that, then somehow I'd be sent back home. And also I was raised not to be ashamed of my body, you know, but it's not like we were taught to just, you know, right. be naked, you know, but right. by the time I went to go do that scene, I think it had really hit me that it caused a lot of trauma for me, you know, to look back and that my everything had been exposed so young in a way that, you know, seemed like really fun and really beautiful in the moment. But when I look back at certain male photographers and I was like, oh my God, you know, like, I can't believe that I was this young and I was, you know, exploited in a way that I didn't understand, and that there was no SAG. There were no right. guilds. There were no protections. It's one of the most unprotected industries in the world, you know, and that, you know, I take issue with that. And mm-hmm. I remember begging not to do that scene. I was just so afraid. It just felt so different to me. And I didn't want to be identified as that, you know. I wanted to play a character without compromising the character, but it didn't seem like I had to do that for any particular reason.
Right.
And I don't think that, you know, but I believed in Denise and I believed in Daniel. And I know in my heart that, you know, they wouldn't have me do that unless they felt like it was important. And it's because there was a woman on set, and it's because I loved Daniel so much that I knew when I expressed, you know, my fear and anxiety about it, that when they talked to me about it, that, you know, that they heard me and that I wasn't pressured into it, that I got to make the choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fun, dark movie. It's like the Dark Meatballs or something, you know?
Yeah, it's based on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even know. I didn't know that. But, well, that must have been fun. You were up at Sundance and was that your
so
first
fun.
Time at Sundance?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember it's like, and that's again when things were really fun and you could meet filmmakers.
Oh, it was the best.
You know?
It was so great. There wasn't like an influx of consumerism. It wasn't
right,
like a whole
gifting suite.
Yeah, I mean,
people were staying in other people's rooms. Okay, so how did you go? And then did you do Blow next?
Yeah.
I worked with Ted Demme. Rest in peace. He's just such a sweet man. But that was like a really cool hip movie that everybody wanted to be in and auditioned for. And
that was Avi Kaufman.
Oh, I love Avi Kaufman.
I mean,
she's a great.
Really credit Avi Kaufman for a lot. You know, Avi didn't have to take a chance on me. Avi, you know, that's when I was still living in New York, and she was a big supporter of mine. She brought me in a lot, and you know, I saw that role, and it was a much bigger role, and I remember going down to Canal Street and like getting, you know, like door knockers. Well, I always wore door knockers, but I loaned them to a friend and I was kind of bummed because I like had this whole like vibe that, you know, I wanted for this character. And, I understood Christina. I knew who she was, you know, and, when I auditioned for it, I obviously got it. And then, you know, being on that set was like paradise because, you know, Penelope Cruz, oh my God, she was like running around with a camera in her hair and just being able to be around women so exquisitely talented, you know, and I didn't ever want to leave that set. Any chance that I get to fly early to a movie or stay later to a movie, I will do it. Even if I'm not working, I will come to set. Like, all I want to do is watch other artists and see what I can learn from them. And there was something about this environment that Ted created that was just so beautiful and you know, open. And at the time, you know, I was studying Strasbourg, and, you know, that was the first time that I went pretty method for something. And, you know, I remember feeling quite sick from it. But the one interesting thing is that Johnny Depp, when I first met him, you know, when I went into his trailer for rehearsals, like, he never left that character. So, like, trailer was exactly like his character, the whole thing. And he never left set. Mm-hmm. So, like, any scene that I was in, even if he wasn't in it, he would always stay there. He would never leave. And, it was interesting because it created a feeling inside of me that my father, you know, who was always supposed to be there, was there in my consciousness, but he was never really, really there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they tested the movie, you know, the scenes, you know, then Emma Roberts played Little Me, you know, when they tested it, the performance was too powerful. So then you didn't like this guy at all. You know, and Ted and I spoke about that. He's like, how do you feel about this? Like, the performance was so effective that everybody hates him. And I was like, well, if everybody hates him, then you got to cut it. Do you know what I mean? Like, and because it didn't make a difference to me, I cared about the overall story, because that was one of the first things I learned, is that how do we affect and what is our place in the overall story and how do we serve that story?
Right.
But what was interesting is that just from that last scene, it was so impactful that's how I got all the other movies after that.
Well, because it was that kind of a film that had a lot of attention too.
Yeah.
But did it go through various cuts and?
I mean, I don't know how many cuts it went through. I think it was just like any film. We were trying to craft it so that people relate to the character, you know, because he wasn't really like a stand-up cat. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
You know, but you still.
But it had elements of, you know, Casino and Ted was a great filmmaker.
Brilliant. And really, Amanda did such a brilliant job with the soundtrack, and you know, the whole team was incredible.
Did you learn anything from that? I always say, like, for each director you work with, did anything from Ted or
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I learned that
he's a good laugher. I always remember that.
Oh my God! Yeah, like that boisterous, beautiful laugh.
Great audience.
Yes, yes. That he cared. He cared about his actors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he cared, and he created a safe space, and he created a sense of freedom in it. Do you know what I mean? And again, he took a chance on me. And so it's like those people in the beginning that really take a chance on you that really change your life, you know, because they could have cast anybody in that.
Right.
And, you know, I just learned from him that, like, what he felt in his heart was real for him, you know, and he was a lover and a really good man.
Yeah, he was. I miss Ted. Okay, now we have to get to Pearl Harbor, which is like, now this seems like classic. You've done all these indies. And then now this is like... Jerry Bruckheimer.
I didn't know what the big deal was. Can I just be honest? I didn't even get it. Like, I went to go to a lunch with the one of the producers on it.
Uh-huh.
I read for Kate Beckinsale's part with Jerry and Michael. They said that I was too young, but then they wanted me to do the film. And there was one role of a nurse that only had one line. And I remember, like, driving back from that NCAA calls, and they're like, oh, my God, this is the biggest deal ever. It's the highest budget movie in the whole world. Blah, blah. And I was like, cool. You know, like, I'm excited. I think it's going to be really great. My grandfather, you know, served in World War II. Like, I wanted to tell this American story, you know, but it wasn't like I was, like, jumping up and down, like, I got the biggest thing in my life. Because, again, I still didn't understand the hierarchy because I was so interested in just the artistry of it. Uh-huh. Like, you know, like, who was directing it was really important to me. But I didn't understand necessarily, like, what a big deal that film was, right? And because I didn't, again, understand what it meant to be the highest budget or whatever. I just cared about the work and the story, you know? So I was very excited, but I didn't think that I was, like, hot shit, you mm-hmm. know? I just thought, great, I know I did a good job. I'm really proud of that. I did what I was supposed to do. What else do I have to do next to go in there, you know? And at that point, they said, will you sit down with Michael and discuss a new character and help create a new character? And so when I, so Michael and I worked together with the writers to create this new character. And really what I wanted Betty to be was to be the Midwest. I wanted her to represent the innocence of America. This idea that, you know, you had these young women and men that were going over to do this very exciting thing that knew that it was their civic duty to be of service. Yet they're going to Hawaii and, you know, it's a person that's never been outside of the Midwest before who lied about her age, you know, to get in. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to capture that wide-eyed enthusiasm and gratitude of being patriotic and what that meant and being away from home for their first time. I wanted to represent that, and I wanted Betty to be that. And so that when this huge tragedy occurred, that, you know, we had the stakes. Mm-hmm. And you had the stakes by when you lose her, you know, you're losing, you know, this innocence, you know, and, you know, what and who she represented, you know, which was purity and love and something so truly genuine. And I wanted to do that for my grandfather and for every person that had served. And, you know, when I got to the set, I was like, oh, this is different. Like, they're like 10 first class plane tickets. It was like, you know, like the one of the most brilliant costume designers in the world. You know, I walked on the set, there's like, you know, bombs going off and sushi at lunch. And I was like, whoa, this is fancy. You know what I mean? And
what part of Hawaii are you in?
We were in Oahu.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we were there for several months.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was like one golden. Giant party in the best way.
Yeah.
You know, because it was like...
karaoke,
you know,
at night.
I mean, everything, yeah. You know, and I for such a weirdo, like goody two shoe, what was great is that I would, you know, study all my scenes, work on all my scenes, you know, get that part done. And then I'd have like 3 weeks off. And then at the time, you know, my boyfriend flew in and then, you know, Ben's girlfriend flew, everybody's, you know, partners flew in. And Josh Hartnett had like beautiful house on the beach, and you know, we were all so compatible and we all had so much fun together.
Yeah.
That it was really great because that community, that the, you mm-hmm. know, the way we commune would translate onto film. Mm-hmm. And I remember people saying, oh, be careful. Michael's like, ugh. And I remember Ben in the beginning was sort of like on the fence of whether or not he was going to do it or not. But I didn't know the history about Michael or what the deal was with Michael Bay and that he could be contentious and yada, yada, yada. My experience with him was very different, you know, mm-hmm. because I dealt with him about writing this character, and Jerry, you know, was fantastic and taught me so much about filmmaking. And, you know, I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, the key about making a great film is that you take something that everybody's heard of, but that they don't know a lot about, you know, like this idea that everybody's heard of Pearl Harbor, but they don't know everything that happened behind it. Mm-hmm. So when you can look for ideas that people have heard about
you know, that are part of the zeitgeist or you know, historically have happened, and you can try and tell those stories, like, that to me really resonated with me. And it wasn't until, you know, I landed and, you know, we were doing like our hair and makeup test, and he's like, okay, you guys need to go to the tanning bed every day. And, you know, he had said something to an actor that called her, oh, you look like a school marm. And then I was like, oh my gosh, here we go. You know, and then I got, cause I'm very protective of women. And I was like, oh, you know, like, why would he say something like that? Who is this person? Like, he kind of changed a little bit. And, you know, one of my first scenes was the huge war scene where I'm running, where his first AD Casey is a genius, and how he holds things together is kind of amazing. But we're standing there, which felt like for hours, for the perfect light. And I walk up to Michael and I say, do you have any instruction for me? He said, yes, run straight and don't fuck it up. And I was like, okay. And I was like a little like confused. It's like when you're like, oh, but this, you're my friend. And what do you mean? Don't fuck it. Like, you know, it was like, all right, so back to my places, and everyone's jittery. And because we had one time to do this, I think it was like a $300,000 shot or something.
Right.
And all I knew is I had to run straight. Lots of things were going to go off, and there were thousands of extras that were going to run, but they didn't tell us where they're going to run. So the light hits right. They call action. I run straight, like my whole life depends on it, and thousands of people are bombarding. There's strafing lines coming up under, like bombs coming up from under my feet. Like, I don't know what's happening, but I make it to the end, and I was like, oh, praise God, I did it. And it was one of the most exhilarating experiences of my entire life. I'd never seen anything like it. And it was just like one of those things that, like, you, like, I'll always remember what that felt like, you know? And There were a lot of things that happened on that set that, you know, someone, you know, there were injuries, there were fights, there were beautiful moments. You know, our DP quit, we had to get another DP. And what I really learned from that was that, you know, when people ask how I feel about him, I'm like, I do love Michael Bay. He has a way of shooting his films, but I understood him. And I remember when it was clicking in my brain and I was sitting by the beach and I was like, oh, Michael Bay is like, you know, like a 7-year-old. He gets excited like a 7-year-old and then angry like a 7-year-old. But he has a particular kind of genius mm-hmm. that's not really explainable. And, you know, he has his own way of making films that, you know, I respect, you know. And so, you know, I don't respect, you know, when people are abusive. I don't respect the way that people can go about things. And I think there's always room for change. But I think once I understood where that came from, you know, and it comes from like a place of lack inside, you know, that was important to me to understand.
Well, he may come from a school, you know, I don't know, I've never met him, but, you know, in the old days, Hollywood, everybody was a, you know, there's so many stories about people like Otto Preminger.
Yeah. Or,
you know, that's all they did was scream at people. And I don't think anyone had the opportunity to say, you know, it really hurt my feeling. You know, like, I think only once in my life I've said, you know, said,
yeah,
you know, it really hurt my feelings when you, like, they look at you like, what? What are you? I didn't even notice.
So something. I know. It's terrifying to even see that. I went through that recently. It was terrifying.
What? Who are you?
Like, okay, deal with it, you know.
But that feels like a movie, but it made me want to see it again. I haven't seen it in years. But I bet, you know, it's the kind of thing, it seems, I guess I'm going to use a word like micromanage. There's just so many people wanting to ensure that this thing is the biggest film of the year. And I don't know if movies have that thing anymore.
No, like,
I
don't think,
except for maybe Star Wars.
I mean, but Star Wars would be the closest thing to it. But you know that, I mean? But that,
something like this has to be a hit. It's got all these people in it.
Yeah.
Big movie, and we're paying a lot of money. And
yeah, I mean, and by the way, the actors that were in that were so brilliant and so fun to work with.
Cooper Gooding, too.
I mean, you know, you awesome. Had so many amazing pieces in the so many, you know, pieces that were going on too, so many units, so much action. I mean, I don't even, like, it's crazy to think how you do something like that, and the responsibility and the weight of someone to right. be able to take that on is huge, you know. And but I remember that as one of the most joyous times of my life, because you know, like, it was heaven. And then, you know, when I went to the premiere, it was the biggest premiere in history. It was, you know, all the troops were there, you know, and it was really felt like I got to pay homage to people yes. that had served. and it was incredibly extravagant. And then I was like, oh, maybe this is how movies are made now. Cut to like my next movie, and I'm in like a triple banger, and I'm like, oh, wait, what's happening? But it didn't matter, you know, but it was still like, yes. I will never forget.
All right, we're going to run out of time. I have to get to Bulletproof. Now, how does one have to do a mental test to get into a film? Is that, that's something I read, research. You had to do a physical and mental test?
Mental test? No, to get into the film. Martial arts test.
In order to get into the into the film.
Yeah, so you didn't tested for that 6 times. Everybody wanted that. It was like every major actor was up for that thing. And then, you know, I was surfing every day. And I remember I found out that I got it when the director was like, okay, you can't surf anymore. And the last test was a physical test.
Oh, I see.
And then a martial arts test. So basically I had to go, and they just told me, you know, to do all these really complex moves. And, you know, I had grown up very athletic and I could do them. Mm-hmm. And then I got the job, and then we trained for 6 months ahead of time. We did all of our own stunts. But that was a movie that ended up being an extraordinary disappointment. You know, I was working with Chow Yun Fat, who I was very excited to work with.
Yeah, the killers.
You know, and didn't, you know, he would leave. You know, he had like a 10-hour time limit. He wouldn't be there for coverage. You know, so I was doing my coverage with like a script supervisor. You know, that was very disappointing, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, the producers all had a different vision of what it was. The director, you know, had only done a music video. And it's like, that movie and my experience with that movie really changed my acting for several years after that, because it made me feel completely confused about my abilities and my talents. Because when I had 4 different people telling me that I was doing something the wrong way, you know, and everybody had a different direction, it just scrambled my insides. And then, and that was the first time I realized I had something to lose, because they're like, this has to come out and open like this. And, you know, it took me many years to unwind from that experience of essentially being told that, you know, that, you know, every direction, everything that I was doing was wrong. And, you know, it wasn't that I was doing something wrong. It's just that there, you know, nobody wanted to decide who was in charge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did anything come out in your, when you watched the movie? I sometimes see if I'm watching a movie, I'm like, oh, that was a horrible day.
Yeah, I can't even watch it. Like, it's really hard for me to watch that movie.
Oh, okay.
And I know people enjoy it, but like, it's hard for me because I remember the impact that it had on me, you know?
Yes. Okay. I hope you like Sin City, because I love
Sin City. Love Sin City. Yes, yes.
Such
that was a
great
game changer.
Stylistic noir. Are you a fan of noir films at all?
Oh, 100%. Like oh, my God. And Robert Rodriguez is like, ugh. He's always obsessed with Rodriguez.
And that seems like, again, a return to something that's fun and cool and hip.
Nothing had been made like that before.
Yeah.
You know, I got a
amazing
call.
Amazing people in
it. Yeah. I was doing White Chicks, got a call that he was a fan of mine. Went to a very ambiguous meeting. They didn't tell me what it was about. I walk in. There's Rodriguez, Mary Verneau, and a guy in the corner with a hat on, sitting like this, Frank Miller. He hands me a graphic novel, asks me if I'll just read along with him. And as soon as I read it, I just immediately felt like this woman. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was doing. I just went for it. And then he showed me a clip of Marlee Shelton and, you know, Josh, of what it was going to look like. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, my God, I've never seen anything like this. Went back up to finish White Chicks, and then got a call 3 months later saying, okay, they're ready and they want to hire you. And, you know, it was the first time, you know, anything had been fully shot green screen, mm-hmm. you know, where everything was done in post. Working with Mickey was extraordinary. Such a generous, gifted, brilliant actor. And, you know, being a part of that film was something I was really, really proud of, really proud of.
Yeah, and it just kind of ushered in a new type of women's role, too.
A strong woman,
like
that ran
badass,
the town.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, there's something about owning that kind of power that wasn't really happening in filmmaking at the time.
And were you aware, when you were shooting it, were you aware that it was good and fun? It's got a nice rhythm to it, you know, and the camaraderie between the women is fantastic.
Yeah, Rosario was, I grew up with Rosario, and we joked we always wanted to do a movie together, except I was acting to a piece of, to an ex of her, you know, and Jessica Alba is the godmother to my child, you know, so we were friends.
Yeah.
Alexis and I were friends, you know, like all of, Devin and I had known each other since we were 14, so it was kind of amazing because all of these women were my girls, you know,
yeah.
And so that was, you know, incredible.
Did you learn any acting tips from Mickey Rourke?
Or? Learned everything from him. Yeah, I remember. You know, he was very like he treated me as he would Wendy. Mm-hmm. And again, he was one of these people who are like, "Are you afraid to work with them?" And I didn't know. I'm like, "What are you talking about?" You know, it was just his dog, myself, and him. That was it, mm-hmm. and no other actors.
Dog.
Right?
I think his dog liked you.
You know, and he the way he would look at me, the way he would push me further and further and further. Like when I had to hit him with that gun,
yeah.
I didn't want to beat the shit out of him, you know, crap out of him. You know, right. but he was like, go for it, you do. Like he was like, go, 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 and he helped me harness my power in a way yeah. that men had never done before. They had not done that for me before. They were never like, stronger, harder, faster. Yeah. You can do it. I know you can.
Yeah.
You know, I had been taught that the strength inside of me was to be utilized in some different way. But he helped me understand mm-hmm. that my physicality, that my strength, that being a woman, that it was okay. And not only just okay, but that I was worthy and it was important for me to show that. And he kept pushing and pushing and pushing me to do that in a way that I'd never done before. And he had liberated me in a way that, you know, like I had never experienced that from a man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even when we had to do these lovemaking scenes, like, you know, I said something so stupid. Oh, my God. I remember he was like, I was like, oh, I'm really nervous. I was like, you know, I've only done this like a couple times before. I was like, you know, have you done it a lot? And he's like, yeah, kid. And I was like, oh, shit. And then all of a sudden it came back to my mind, duh, like, you know, every movie that I'd seen of him. But he put a pillow in between. He's like, here's the trick. You put a pillow in between the two of us.
Okay.
And no other guy had done that, you yeah. know? So he put all of these buffers, like, between us, right? So that, like, our bodies weren't really touching. And right. I found that to be deeply respectful because no other guy had done that.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, he was so gentle and honest with me, mm-hmm. you know? And then he wrote me a really beautiful letter after we wrapped. And, you know, my mentor and best friend passed away last year. Her name is Elizabeth Kemp. And she was the head of the Actors Studio. And she passed away in my arms. And she, you know, Mickey was in love with her. You know, she's Bradley, you know, she worked all on Star is Born. She's been Bradley Cooper's teacher for 20 years. And, you know, Hugh Jack, I mean, everybody, you know, mm-hmm. really brilliant human being. And, you know, I remember him, you know, I heard this crash outside and Mickey comes in, he'd broken like a bottle of whiskey or something. And he falls over onto her. And I remember him just squeezing and saying, nobody understands that we just lost our best actor. Mm. Our best actor. And, you know, it was just this really crushing, beautiful moment, you know, to see that, you know what I mean? Mm. And I don't know how to explain it, you know?
No, it's beautiful. I mean, it's just such an insight into, I don't think that people think of movies as people training and having mm. teachers and putting their, you know, their life's blood into the films. We just think of the films, you know. Nowadays, I don't feel like it's as celebrated, you know, back in the day of, like, Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
That there were teachers and James Dean and these
exactly.
people.
Exactly. And, you know, she was appointed by, you know, Tennessee Williams and Strasberg, and she was, you know, the head of the master's class mm-hmm. there and at Pace and at, you know, all over. She was on the Jungian Institute. And, you know, when you have a woman like Elizabeth Kemp and, you know, Sandra Seacat and, you know, Greta and Susan Batson and Nancy Banks, and then you have, like, Jean-Louis, who does almost everyone's voice work, and, you know, you have these, movement work, and when you have Eric Vitor, you have these, you know, you have so many teachers right. that I think the public needs to understand that without them, these performances wouldn't fully be realized. You know, we all need to be taught. We always need someone else to help us go deeper, mm-hmm. to help us do the dream work, to help us do the work, script analysis, all of these kinds of things, so that the places that we're afraid to look into our shadow side, if we're afraid to delve deeper or whatever, that we have these very gifted artists, some of the most brilliant artists in the world, that are guiding us through and holding us to a responsibility. And whenever I was stuck, she said, just do what you were given. just do what you were given. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wish the public knew more about how, you know, their favorite performances that they see every year, the people behind it.
So we're going to run out of time. So, but before you go, what is this show that you're doing now, which is called Black Summer on Netflix?
Yes, Black Summer. We just wrapped. It is, it's coming out in April. I'm very excited about it. I play a character named Rose, and really it is I've never done anything like it. John Himes is the showrunner and director and writer, and he's brilliant, Peter Himes' son. And ultimately, it's if the country continues to go the way that it goes, this is what it would look like.
Oh no!
And he wrote it. He wrote it because he saw his wife go through a huge tragedy, and he fell apart, but his wife didn't. And he wanted to write something about the strength of women, mm-hmm. and what women, not what we won't do for those that we love, but what wouldn't we do? And so, you know, I play, you know, a woman who is separated from her daughter at a refugee spot and loses her husband. And the whole series is me trying to get to my child, and in a world where there is no, there's a sickness that's going on that's like MRSA, it looks kind of like zombies, but it's not. It's like that's symbolic for the division and the hatred in the country. And, you know, how people are stealing gas and food and water and, you know, like that, you know, nobody can trust anyone. But really, like, what does it mean to have to survive on your own and yet find people around you to help you through this journey? And ultimately, this is about a woman that's seemingly ordinary that is quite extraordinary. And it's, you know, the people that don't make it through, or the people that are either caught in their ego or their hubris or things like that. But what is consistent about her is her humanity and her unwillingness to I wouldn't say unwillingness, I would say her deep need to protect, you know, the innocent and have a bright, like to continue to be some bright spot in the world whilst at the same time doing whatever it takes to get to her child.
That sounds very serious.
Wow. It is serious.
That sounds very serious.
It took me a long time to come down from that. Now I'm ready to do a comedy because, you know, we shot it like a play. We did it on like Warners and like I like, you know, it's been difficult coming down from it. You know, I was glad we shot in Canada because, you know.
You're also an entrepreneur.
Yes.
Which is a lot of fun too.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that I was reading some of the things you're involved with. My God. You're
is that the Forbes one?
No, this was the
Forbes article.
Which I didn't like. I wasn't going to bring it up because
you said to the girl. That was my first Forbes article. And I said, I was like, please don't say that I'm a girl boss.
It's
like
in the very first paragraph.
I said, whatever. Can we just not call me a girl boss? Can we just call me a girl boss?
First line is like, and then she goes, right. I love when they do that. They sit down, they go, she sat down and had a Coca-Cola and soup. And then you think, well, that's one page. But no, this is I read, aside from the stupid title, I thought it was a great article.
Thank you,
because it was talk about filling a gap in the market, saving your money, don't be afraid to be female, start small then go big. It's a decluttering. I thought it was great. So. Aside from the stupid title, I recommend the article 10 Tips.
Yeah, people. It was actually one of their best selling articles, which was best great. Fact, which was great.
I think
it's literally the anti business model to how to become successful.
I think
which is like support independent women. You know, don't worry about the money. So support like ethical things. You know,
connect with
people.
Yes.
You know, don't try and act like a man. You know, utilize what makes women amazing. I find that. CEOs now try and act like a lot of CEOs take on masculine qualities rather than embracing who they are as female.
Right.
You know, rather than rejecting other women, embrace women and realize that there's enough at the table for all of us. It's like, you know, entrepreneurship really came to me just because I look back at the way what my mom could have done, or when I see something in another person, I just want to be involved in that. And as an artist, and I'm sure you understand this, I just want to create things, you know, but create things that have value and create things that will last for a long time and have an impact on the planet. Like I created the first gender fluid line for children, and you know, like there's a lot of different things that I've done, but I've done it in a way that, you know, is sort of the antithesis of the way that a lot of, you know, artists do it now, which is that, you know, you just put your name on anything and sell it. Everything that I've been a part of, I've made from the beginning. And I remember, you know, my agents being like, you're going to make nothing from this. And I was like, you don't understand. It's not about that. It's about the bigger picture, and the money will come if you do things that the consumers need and that you're respecting what women need.
Right. All righty. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for being here, Jamie.
Thank you.
Please come back anytime.
I will.
You can find Jamie on Twitter and Instagram at @JAIME_King, and look for her Netflix series Black Summer in April 2019. Thank you, Jamie. Also, you can buy Ileana's book,
Island
Dennis Hopper, now out in paperback.
You're going to get that copy.
I am?
Yeah. And in bookstores. It's a great read. You should buy it. Also, check us out on Facebook, and the website is ileanaspodcast.com.
And I am going to end with my quote, but I must say, a couple times I was talking to you, and you do bear a striking resemblance to Lauren Bacall. Have you ever been told
yes.
that?
Yes. Yeah, that's a great honor. Yes.
A couple times I was like, I said, you should, if they do a Lauren Bacall movie, you've got to do...
Oh, I would love that.
Got to be Lauren Bacall. Aside from me fantasizing while you're talking, I'm going to end by saying everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. I love how I have to look at it. It's my philosophy. Everyone's life is a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. This is the end of our movie and our podcast. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thank you so much,
have a great
you guys.
Day. Go out and vote. Go out vote.
See you next time.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.